Welcome to Risk Revolution, a podcast series that examines all aspects of risk management in the life sciences industry. We'll talk to industry experts on best practices for identifying risk, assessing risk, measuring solutions, implementing solutions, and monitoring results. Here are your hosts, Nuala Callan, Valerie Mulholland, and Lori Richter.
Well, welcome back to Risk Revolution, the podcast where we challenge the status quo in quality risk management, culture, and leadership. And this month, the whole band is back together and we're doing something a little different. And I'll have to admit, I have been looking forward to this one. We are delving onto the bookshelves for the books that have us thinking and talking and yes, even disagreeing a little. So whether you're a seasoned quality leader or new to QRM, these reads might just change how you think about and manage risk. Lori, what's happening on your end?
All right. Well, I just want to say that I'm thinking that this book club will be a little nerdy session with us ladies covering some leadership topics and how they integrate into the QRM world. We've got a brilliant mix of titles today. We have Amy Edmondson's The Fearless Organization and The Right Kind of Wrong. That was a really favorite of mine. And then we have David Marquette's Turn the Ship Around. That was my selection for this book club. And then, of course, the new edition of Quality Risk Management, A Practical Guide, which Val will dig into. And spoiler alert, we don't agree on everything, as Nuala said.
Yeah, it's like the book club without the biscuits. And if you've ever wondered what happens when a culture guru, that's you, Nuala, and a people-first pragmatist, that's you, Lori, and a little risk management nerd like myself, when we get together and read books, well, buckle up, this is what happens. And we're going to see, I'm sure we won't all see these books the same way. But you know what? I think it will bring out that risk isn't just a number or, you know, an RPN number or whatever. You know, it is a reflection of how we lead, what we value, how we learn, and leadership without learning. I guess that's the real nonconformance. Huh?
Yes, I feel like that should be on a poster somewhere right next to Kappas are people too.
Yeah, that would work for the merch when we get the merch. Merch coming up.
All right. So let's dive into the shelf then, the bookshelf. First up, what happens when you stop punishing mistakes and start learning from them? And this was my pick for the, well, not just the author. I've used her work many, many times, Amy Edmondson. And she has a few things to say about that. Now, she started some time ago. The first book that I had read of Amy Edmondson's was The Fearless Organization. And obviously with me being the culture guru, as you referred to me, Val, I had delved into her work around this previously. And she, I guess, to some extent, introduced to our side of the industry anyway, this concept of psychological safety. And it was certainly the first place that I had kind of come across this concept of psychological safety within an organization. And not only did she kind of coin the phrase for me, but she linked it to high performance in her Fearless Organization. So it wasn't just about creating psychological safety or that we're all zen and we're all, you know, happy clappy. It's actually linking the fact that you won't achieve the high performance unless there is a safe space for people to step forward with their ideas and with their mistakes and, you know, feeling that they can raise their voice. She talks about this in terms of like having, how does she define this? She even defines it as a culture where it's safe to express ideas. And I love that concept because we're not always talking about somebody fessing up that they've seen something unusual or even a near miss or a mistake. We're just trying to engage people to step forward with ideas. I've seen something or I've been thinking about something and I wonder, can we try to do an improvement here? You know, what can we do to improve our outcomes here? So that links then to her second point in this book, which is around nurturing engagement and candor. And she says, which is required by a knowledge economy. So again, it's not just, you know, let's all be kind to each other and let's nurture engagement. It's actually a requirement now in the knowledge economy that we socialize and we engage with each other. because no matter how good our SharePoints or our AI tools are or anything else, and we've talked about it on the podcast before when it comes to AI and knowledge management, if we don't nurture engagement where people are actually have opportunities to have conversations in a candor approach, which means we're willing to disagree or we're willing to try something, but we're willing to speak up with our ideas. And I loved one of the terms that she has in it, and I read it completely wrong, possibly an American, you know, European concept. But she said we have to shed the yes men approach. And I guess by that she means like get rid of the yes men approach. But I actually read it as we need to put the yes men in a shed. And I think that would equally work well as well. And yeah, I definitely... I've worked with a few of those that I'd have loved to have locked in a shed in my past. But yeah, we have to shed the yes men approach where we're all nodding donkeys around a table. And once the leader or the subject matter expert, you know, we've seen this in risk situations, which is why, you know, we routinely now would ask the expert to speak last, so that we're not expecting everybody to say, oh, well, what he said, yeah, you know, rinse and repeat on that. And Amy Edmondson speaks about this. In order to shed that yes-men approach, we need to fertilize creativity. It helps us to clarify our goals. We achieve accountability, which along with engagement are the two key concepts that I think we, you know, for that culture to work, we've got to be able to get the engagement. And that engagement for me, that accountability, driving accountability, which is a team sport for me. It's not about individuals being held to account. It's actually the team supporting that individual to be able to get their best work done and to have the support of the team and the team to have their back in the event that they're slipping off course. And then she also defines this fearless organization as a need to redefine leadership. So I think there's a whole lot there just in book one. And I just love all the anecdotes. I love her writing style. She brings in all sorts of different types of organizations, and she does the same in the second book. But before I move on to The Right Kind of Wrong, which is really the one that I wanted to focus on today, Val or Laurie, do you have any comments there about that fearless organization and building a culture of engagement and accountability?
I'll just add a little bit, and I know Val, you probably also want to comment on the psychological safety piece. So I won't go too deep into that. And it comes up in the next book as well. It's her theme. It's where her research is done. But I would just add that tying it back to the quality system or to quality risk management too, is that you can't have that space to talk about these things open if you don't create that environment. And I think psychological safety, unfortunately, got mislabeled, at least in, I'll speak from the US or American culture. When it came out, it was kind of viewed as, oh, I have to create this safe space so that people can cry kind of thing. And it's not about that. It's actually exactly how you described it, Nuala. It's about creating a space where debate is actually encouraged. You discuss, you disagree, you come to the best of those worlds. And that's what that was supposed to be about. And somehow that sort of got mislabeled. I think it's in a better space now, but when it was kind of initially thought of, I think it wasn't rolled out in the right way or taken in a wrong way. But anyway, I think it's important from a risk management perspective. Risk is a vulnerability. Risk is pointing out that something may potentially go wrong and bad. And if you don't have that space to be able to bring that up, you're never going to be able to appropriately assess and manage risk. So I just wanted to tie it back to that. And I know Val, you probably have a lot to contribute to that whole concept as well.
Yeah, well, just on this book, rather than The Right Kind of Wrong, which we're coming to, I think when I was looking over this book, I think ringing in my ears was that insight we discussed in the last episode, Nuala, our cafe episode, that silence is also a risk. You know, when things go wrong and it turns out that people knew it was going to happen, could happen, did happen, was about to happen, et cetera, but said nothing. That silence is in itself a risk. So, you know, when you look at it that way, I don't know, psychological safety isn't so much a nice to have as a almost a prerequisite for a QRM that works, because if people don't feel safe to speak up Are they even going to assess risk honestly? Are they going to, put things on the table honestly? It really is a very good background read for that. I'd agree
It
with you.
is. And I like because it leads in nicely to The Right Kind of Wrong. A lot of her concepts from the Fearless Organization feed in nicely into The Right Kind of Wrong. And particularly, what you've just said there, Val, around, how silence can be a vulnerability and a risk. And in The Right Kind of Wrong, she talks about, how failures arise and our approach to failures. And she particularly, talks about the fact that we're often embarrassed by failures. So we don't want to talk about them because we're a bit embarrassed about the fact that we didn't understand something, or we didn't know, or we got it wrong, or we're afraid to be seen to be wrong in front of our peers. And I think that that again is really what she's getting at with that psychological safety. We've got to make it okay for people to say, I don't know. I actually don't know the answer here, or I don't know why we do this way. I've just always done it this way, but I actually don't understand, the kind of science behind why I'm doing it. And I'd love if somebody here around the table would explain it to me. That's the kind of safety that we want when we're bringing forward risks and when we're trying to understand and assess them, is making sure that there is no fear of being seen to be, on the back foot or somehow not as intelligent as everybody else in the room. Because, as we know, when we want those cross-functional teams, we want to encourage, new hires and juniors and interns to step forward and say, well, this is all new to me, so could somebody help me understand? And for that to be that level of curiosity to be not only valued but like celebrated when somebody is able to surface where there's a knowledge gap or a perceived gap in what we understand, or indeed helping to level set. We may all have different understandings, but because we're all nodding dogs and we're doing the yes men thing, we may not realize that we have different perceptions on the other side of the table. So that really leads in nicely to the way she tees up the whole thing of the right kind of wrong and there being an acknowledgement that things will go wrong, and that we therefore have to acknowledge those wrongs. And the way in which we can do that is we can turn them into a right. The right kind of wrong. And I loved that. So in her Right Kind of Wrong book, I loved when she said, we're used to thinking about failure as a problem, something to be avoided. And then she said, we've gone through this whole, kind of innovative tech world where we're actually told, oh, fail fast, fail often. And she said both of those assumptions are the wrong way of approaching failure. Neither of those are helpful, really. They're slogans rather than anything else. And certainly, seeing it as a problem rather than a learning experience, which of course is where she comes to. But she said learning to fail is the route to true success. So it's actually learning about failure and learning how we handle failure is the route of success. We need to, but we often fail to learn. We put off the hard work of reflecting on what went wrong. We want, oh, let's move to the solution phase. We have a problem. Do we understand the problem? Okay, now let's move to the solution. And of course, often in our sector, we're dealing with a lot of, engineers and scientists who are naturally kind of predisposed to be problem solvers. And they don't really want to take the time to reflect on what went wrong and what can we learn from it, which is actually, it's the gold. It's the, it's the true source of our success. And even in finding the right solution, if we haven't done that kind of reflection, it'll be hard to necessarily say we'll get to the right solution or the root cause, as is often what's talked about. So I loved that many of us go out of our way to avoid experiencing failure. So there's another thing that can happen when we don't have the psychological safety of failure is we're not we're not taking chances to learn. We're not taking chances to advance the business or to look for opportunities to improve, because we'd rather stay in the steady lane, in our own lane, rather than potentially experience failure, which of course is not a growth mindset that we've talked about before. So these are all the kind of underpinning behaviors that she talks about in The Right Kind of Wrong. And of course, then she goes on to give three distinctive types of failure. And in each of those cases, she talks about, you know, why, how they can arise, how they can be prevented, and what can we learn from each of them. So it's very, very interesting as you read through the book. It's quite, she has the basic failures, the complex failures, and the intelligent failures. And in each of those cases, she works through, you know, how can they arise? What types of failures are we talking about? And then how can we prevent them? But just coming back to those kind of basic failures, you know, she talks about, you know, these are errors. Sometimes we'll refer to them as error or mistakes that can happen. You know, simple things like she talks about, you know, the cereal going in the fridge and the milk going in, you know, putting your milk away in the cupboard. So there's no real consequence. You might have some sour milk, but like, it's not going to kill anybody. They're a basic kind of failure. And largely those ones are down to inattention, and they're preventable. Typically, they're preventable, what we would call preventable errors, with a bit more attention to detail. And again, slips and trips and things like that, that can be averted with care and attention. And they often happen over due to overconfidence or just downright neglect to people, you know, following the rules. And these are all things that we would be very familiar with. I suppose to a certain extent, some people are still referring to them in our industry as human errors. I like to refer to them as preventable errors, because that's exactly what they are. So she gives lots of really good examples of that. In fact, one of the examples that she gives, which I really liked, was, you know, they talked about two airline crews. Where one which had come off the back of several days of flying as a crew, and then they were put into a flight simulator, and then and they were exhausted, and they, you know, long shifts and long flights and everything, but they literally had come off shift, and they were put into the simulator. The other teams then were flight crews that had been on their furlough. They were off duty. They'd had their rest period, and then they were put into the simulator. And funny enough, non-intuitively, it's the team that were fatigued that had less errors than the team that were well rested. And it was literally because they were just slightly rusty. It was those kind of slips and trips and errors that are entirely preventable. And it was because the team that were fatigued were working as a cohesive unit, and they'd come off working as a cohesive unit, and they'd reflected on things during their shifts or whatever. Whereas the team that were coming in, you know, had been whatever, at home with their families or, you know, taking some rest days, and they weren't yet cohesed as a team. So it was kind of interesting to I just liked that example of thinking about it. Intuitively, you'd think the fatigue team would make more mistakes, but they didn't actually. They were closer to each other. Then when you get to those complex errors, now I liked what she talks about, and I think these are the ones that kind of trip us up a lot. They're archetypically different from the basic errors, but they happen in familiar settings that we're very familiar with, but they're complicated. So they can have external factors. They can be multi-causal. But interestingly, she said, they often have early warning signs, which we ignore. And they often happen in environments that are, like I say, subject to external factors. So the examples she gives there are, you know, busy A&E, accident and emergency departments in hospitals, where somebody can mark up the wrong leg, you know, the knee, is it the left knee or the right knee? So they do have a consequence, you know, deeper consequences than putting the cereal in the wrong shelf. And in the fridge. She also mentioned complex supply chains, which I think us as an industry, we've had, you know, a huge amount of learning with complex supply chains and all of the things that can go wrong there with external and multi-causal factors. Again, but well-known and early warning signs very often ignored, or opportunities to reflect on near misses often ignored. So They, I really honed in on that chapter and where she talked about how, you know, how we can deal with those. Again, not surprisingly, she said they can be systems driven because the system has become over complex. So again, I think many with the listeners will say, yeah, we know we have several of those t-shirts where we've actually created the monster because our systems are so complicated and complex. And then I guess the last one that she really talks about is those intelligent errors. And I guess these are the ones that, you know, we can learn from all of them, of course. But the intelligent errors are the ones where we can make a significant leap forward. And I guess the environment that she talks about there is like science, you know, drug discovery, where, you know, 70% of what's happening in many scientific experiments is failure. But it's actually moving you forward. It's you now have more knowledge about your subject because you've discounted a hypothesis and you're able to move on to the next opportunity. But you've learned something from the failure. So that's the intelligent ones. And again, she gives really great details about how we can really lean in and welcome these, celebrate these, as opposed to seeing them as a form of failure. I just loved this book. I could have licked this off a spoon. I loved every bit of it. It was really resonated with me. I would urge anybody to either get the audiobook because there is one, or, you know, just pick up the paperback and start underlining bits that really, really, it is astonishing how, even though she's talking about many, many different types of organizations and different types of environments, it really resonated with me how important it is that we take the time to reflect and learn from our mistakes and that we welcome mistakes as a teachable moment, really. I don't know. Laurie, what's your thoughts on Amy and The Right Kind of Wrong?
No, I love her as well. And I've read both of those books and used her when I was doing my PhD thesis and referenced her in there. I think the one thing I wanted to say was taking us back to when we're kids and we learn how to ride a bike, we don't fall off the bike and just go away and never get back on the bike again. We keep getting back on the bike and we keep falling off the bike. And it's funny that as adults, that for some reason, that part gets away from us. And we suddenly feel like if we can't get on this bike, whatever that thing is that you're calling the bike, and do it perfectly, it's not worth doing. And I think that's so sad because you have so many missed opportunities to learn and to have those conversations and to debate or to talk or to get somebody else's experience on it or a different approach. So I think that environment that she often refers back to in many of her books, I think is just so critical. And I'll even tie it to something like, because I know Val will probably tie it really well to risk or something, but I'm going to tie it to a QSMR or a QMR when you look at the health of your quality system, which is often, I know, a lagging indicator and not the best thing that's proactive. But I don't know if you notice it. I do. Humans tend to want to manipulate the metrics so that we meet whatever the target is versus throwing it up there and saying, this is where we're at. What can we learn from this? And what can we do to improve and make it better? We tend to want to make it green, make it go away, make it perform well or look like it does because we don't want to expose that vulnerability or that risk. And I thought back about what you were saying, Nuala, about the engineers and people, engineers or what have you, are driven to solution development. You're right. But I also wonder if it's culturally a little bit of a shame element that makes us drive to solution. It's like, let's not talk about the issue. Let's just fix it. And I think it's great that we want to fix those things. But we can't fix it until we discuss what happened here, right? And kind of learn from that. And that goes back to inadequate root cause analysis, which the US FDA loves to cite. So I think we really do need to wrap our minds around creating that culture because it is propagating and causing us problems throughout our industry. And certainly there are pockets like R&D where learning from mistakes is how we develop, right? To your point. So why do we lose that somewhere else in the product life cycle and not want to have those hard conversations to understand what really happened there and develop a good solution? But I'm going to turn it over to Val then.
Yeah, before we jump you in there, Val, just one thing, another quote that I took from the book. Amy Edmondson says, better teams don't necessarily make more mistakes. They're just better at discussing them. Yes. And that's to your point there, yeah. Laurie. Yeah. And I think that, you know, we need to remember, like, we need to make some posters out of some of these for sure. Val, what are your thoughts?
More ideas for the merch, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, Laurie, you're right. I was kind of thinking of it and reading the book in the context of, like, what could a cura practitioner get out of this, you know, and what could you extract that might help your, you know, your day job? And I think one thing that really struck me is, as you guys know, ICHQ 901 brought in this idea of complexity and how we should maybe apply lower, higher formality, and it's a spectrum depending on how complex an issue is. And I thought there was, you know, in Amy's taxonomy there of failure, there, you know, that I think would develop our thinking around levels of complexity. So she talks, as you said, Nuala, about the basic failures. They're preventable, they're well understood. And actually, as I was reading it, I was kind of getting a little distressed about how so many of our QRM tools, they really are designed to look at those basic one failure at a time sort of scenarios. Whereas when you look at her next level of failure, which was kind of complex failure, where systems and interdependencies break down and there's a lot happening, you know, we're not so good at applying tools that will allow us to foresee and forethink those particular scenarios. So I thought there was really good thinking there. And then the intelligent failures, the one we should welcome because they teach us something. I mean, how seldom when we think about it, do we sit down and review our QRM system and our methodologies? And if a risk control isn't adequately managed, was it because it was, you know, just something that we couldn't predict or prevent, or should we have done better there? You know, like, I can't help but think how often we treat deviations and issues like they are disasters, or the other extreme, in a complete nuisance, when in fact, you know, there are opportunities for people to learn and improve our risk management system. So I think this book will give readers a better language for something that we've felt a long time in our industry, that our systems, and including our quality risk management system, they're designed for compliance and not necessarily for curiosity.
Yeah.
And if we want to build resilient systems, if we want to learn, then I agree, we need to get more comfortable with failure and learning from it. So yeah, can I put in a few downsides?
Yeah.
Because you guys were so enthusiastic about the book. I thought there was a bit too much theory in the book, you know, really useful theory now, but it was, And I can't help but think if you were kind of knee deep in you know, SOP writing or deviation investigation or QRM or whatever, it was hard to extract what could I do at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, you know. So it was a really, really insightful why book. But I guess I might just have loved a bit more of how. But maybe that's our job. Maybe, you know, Amy's message is spot on. So maybe we have to take those ideas and translate them into practice and, you know, rethink our culture, rethink our approaches, our mindsets, and build them into our structures and failures. Yeah, so look, psychological safety, learning from failure, quality risk management, there was a lot in common. I think maybe the two disciplines don't spend enough time hanging around the water cooler together and exchanging language and thoughts and mindsets. But there's a lot to take from this book if you have the, you know, headspace to sit down and just lean into it. Now, I read the book, maybe the audiobook would have been better. I'm hearing you guys
in
that.
Maybe I did audio. Yes.
I have actually all three. That'll tell you how much I love this book. I bought the paperback. I know. And then when I really I typically go and buy the Kindle because I might want to quote something from it. And I also had the audiobook going while I was out walking the dog. So that'll tell you now. I really, really did enjoy this. But I do take your criticism there, or constructive criticism, Val. She is spot on in defining the, you know, the why. Or the what. But perhaps, I mean, she does talk about how you can prevent, but, you know, every single error and failure is different. So I guess we have to come up with the how of how are we going to implement this as part of our the way in which we work, and getting those reflective practices in and getting those lessons learned in then. Anyway, we've talked about fear and we've talked about failure. And now let's talk about flipping the power dynamic, because learning cultures don't just happen. They're built especially by leaders who recognize that they're not always the smartest person in the room. So, Laurie, what about your book?
Yeah, so let's talk about David. I want to call him Captain David Marquette, just to be appropriate, but I think it's David Marquette and then calling him Captain Marquette throughout the book. But I actually did listen to this on Audible. It was his voiceover, which was actually really nice. And it's called Turn the Ship Around. I'm going to start out by prefacing this book with, because Val, since you gave some constructive criticism, I'm going to start out by the book I selected and actually giving it a little constructive criticism for the listeners. This is really heavy on military language. That didn't resonate with me as well. I don't have that connection. So it was hard for me sometimes to follow what levels people were in the organization, how the organization was kind of constructed. And, or but, however we want to put that, you can translate that in your head to how your organization might look. There's leaders and there's second level, and then there's more of the doer. So you can kind of think of it that way when you're listening to it. He also quite often references the different types of vessels that he's on. That was a little bit heavy for me. I'm not familiar with different types of nuclear subs or, you know, all the sort of military equipment or things that are on it. So that was a little bit hard for me at times. And the book had some really good and great thoughts. So I'll go there now. But I just wanted to preface that that part was a little tough. But as I had stated in an earlier conversation that we had before we started recording this, U.S. leadership tends to lean a little bit heavy on military constructs sometimes to guide that U.S. leadership style. So that may not resonate sort of with some other folks, but I noticed that that's a heavy theme. And also sports and coaches tend to be a guiding star for a lot of organizational leaders in industry. So maybe that's why some of these books get a little heavy like that. All that being said, I felt like the concepts were really great in the book. So if you can get your mind a little bit away from some of that detail, I think there's great key things. So I'll give a little background. He is the captain of a nuclear submarine in the U.S. Military Navy, and he was taking over a crew for the USS Santa Fe that was actually in a little bit of disarray. Its performance wasn't great. There was really low morale on the vessel, and he was coming into this situation. So that was really tough for him. And he believed in a concept called leader-leader that he goes into quite, that's really the basic concept of the book. And when he walked into this organization, he noticed right away that people were constantly telling him or asking him questions or, I need to take care of this, what do I do? You know, kind of attitude. And he was really overwhelmed because he doesn't like that concept. It's not efficient. He also has to be up 24 hours a day answering all the questions because he's the captain of the ship. So he immediately tried to, I think, empower the people to, hey, you know this piece of equipment better than I know this piece of equipment. What would you do? You know, kind of way of thinking. And it was a really tough transition for that staff. But what he noticed was that they were so used to asking permission to do things that they were really disenfranchised and not really very happy in their role, because all humans like to have some level of power over something that they're doing because they spent a lot of time learning about this thing and now they want to manage that, right? So it was really interesting to listen to him go through his transition of the USS Santa Fe. It eventually became a very high performing nuclear submarine. The staff was much more engaged, but he had to start with a certain level of the organization to get them on the right page before he could transition the rest of the organization to actually reinforce that they had control over whatever the area of expertise they had. And the truth was, he had been through a round already at that point of what he felt was a failure on a former vessel because he knew it so well. He knew how everything operated. So in this case, he did a different approach where he toured and had people tell him how things operated, and he didn't get so engrossed and learn, because then he couldn't make the decisions, right, if he didn't have the knowledge. So I'll talk a little bit about the three pillars that he has, and what I and how I kind of feel that those sort of equate in the quality world in pharma, because I know this is very military focused, but it actually does quite well translate. So the first thing is control. Push those decisions down. And we've all talked about that. Micromanagers are the worst people on the planet to work for. You literally have no freedom or capability to do anything. They're constantly driving all the decisions. The idea here is push the decision down to the appropriate level for that appropriate decision, for that person's area of expertise, for the place that they should have the control over that thing. So I thought that was an important pillar. And I'll explain something that I also really like about the book and the way it's designed and the flow of it at the end. The second is competence. So build it before giving control. I think where we've failed, or where I've seen organizations fail that try to empower and drive decisions down, is they just start going, here, you make the decision. And they sort of walk away. And it's like, no, you have to build the competence before you can drive the decision down. Because otherwise the person doesn't feel like they have the expertise. Maybe they don't have the confidence or the background. Until you drive that, you can't really force those decisions down. So he talks about that. Third is clarity. Everyone knows the mission. Now, if you've ever worked at a company, and I have, where it is very unclear to me the direction we're headed, or it changes on a daily basis, that is infuriating and frustrating. And it is very difficult for me to make a decision, because today I'm not sure that we're in the same place that we'll be tomorrow. And sometimes there is a lot of very, you know, shift in direction in a pharma company. Maybe a product failed, or, you know, something happened and we have to shift direction, but then everyone should be clear that that direction shifted, right? So that now I can change my decisions based on that new direction. And then one of the key concepts he talks about a lot was teaching people to walk up to him to say, "Captain, I intend to," instead of "Can I?" So that was kind of a neat, empowering statement that he had to teach a lot of people. They would come up and ask if they could do something instead of saying, "I intend to do this." And then he would hear them, hear why they intended to do it, and then say, "That sounds great, go do," kind of thing. So I thought that was really an empowering piece. What I really loved about the book when I started out with the, hey, it's heavy on this, is every chapter at the end, he actually would go through in the Audible piece, and I'm sure it's written into the book as well. He would go through in your organization, do this, assess this. And he had kind of this really nice little worksheet that he would go through at the end of things you could do to practically apply these concepts. And it wasn't heavy on the military language. It really did open it up to show this could be applied to all kinds of organizations and all kinds of industries. So I think he did a nice job with that. While the story had to be steeped in the military piece, because that's where he was doing all his work, he nicely ended each chapter with, here's how you can apply these concepts in your organization, or the questions you should ask, or challenge this. So and where I see this most valuable is in quality decision making and in quality culture. I'll drive it to that for a second. When we see phrases like quality is owned by all, it's like, what does that mean? And I think this type of organization drives that. It pushes down those right decisions to the right organizations. Build that competence before you do that. Have that vision of what quality means in your company, so that when people make those decisions, they can link it back to that vision. So I think it nicely translated well to our industry and opened up a lot of thoughts for me. I also I've done this before in our past episodes. I've, you know, spouted praises about his TED talk that he did that was really great, that you can look up, and it shortens obviously all the stuff that's in the book and kind of gets to those concepts a little bit quicker. So all in all, I thought it was a great book if you can get past sort of some of that heavier stuff that just might not resonate with you because it's really military focused. So anyway, Val, yeah. Any thoughts, or Nuala?
Yeah, I agree with you, Laurie. Val here. You know, I suppose I was slightly excited about the book because, remember, one of the reasons our attention was drawn to it was Barry Byrne raised it back in episode 23, I think, of the podcast. And, you know, he recommended it. It's one of the books that had the biggest impression on him. And no, but he does have a military background. And I was saying to myself, I was bracing myself for that. You know, as an Irish woman, I'll be honest, the whole yes, sir, yes, ma'am culture doesn't sit, you know, I don't relate to it. So I was fully expecting this to be one of my least favourite books in the bunch. And I have to say, I was wrong, completely wrong. I loved this book. Okay, it was a bit of work, particularly at the start with your, navigating around what a submarine and submarine command, military command looked like. But as you say, the book went further than that. And it, you know, it wasn't really about command. It was about enabling. It was about trust rather than control. I think in the end, he sort of flipped the script. You know, as somebody who spent a lot of time studying decision making, moving the decision making to where the information lives with the people closest to the problem. I mean, gosh, how often do we say that? But how often do we actually do that? You know, how many times do we involve the people we should involve in risk assessments or in issue resolution or whatever. And, you know, I think for those of us in QRM or even in the wider PQS, that's a game changer, I think, just thinking about that. And, you know, he built a culture of accountability and safety. And, you know, people spoke up because their voices mattered and they took ownership and they felt they had something to contribute. And I think that is the holy grail for us, empowering teams to make confident, informed, risk-informed decisions. You know, funnily enough, in terms of the practicality, and you were saying that, Laurie, you know, there was this, you know, sort of summary at the end of each chapter which gave you practical steps. And, you know, I licked that off the spoon, Nuala, as you were saying. You know, I found, funnily enough, the week after I read the book, well, actually, I too listened to it on audio, I'll confess. I believe that's considered cheating, but it worked great for me. You know, it was very easy to listen to. But the following week, I had two separate client calls, right? Both of which let me test drive some of these ideas. Now, I did have to check my bias barometer first, right? Make sure I wasn't going with a bit of recency bias here, you know, the latest shiny thing and you're off. It's the solution to everything. But, you know, the fit was perfect. And I'll just give you the two examples. The first call, I had a company where nobody raised a deviation about an issue because everybody thought somebody else would do it, you know? Everybody assumed it was somebody else's responsibility. And again, you know, as part of the Kappa and what we do about that, you know, I brought in a little bit of leader thinking and I pulled out a RASi tool and who is responsible, who's accountable, who needs to be consulted, who needs to be informed. That's the RASi concept. And just, you know, see, could we learn from why that wasn't raised the last time and really kind of clarify those responsibilities and accountabilities for the next time? And boom. Instant clarity applied to the situation. I felt a bit like a submarine commander myself at the end of it. And then second call, same issue, different flavor. Here, it wasn't that nobody raised a deviation. This is a more ongoing situation where folks outside of quality were feeling they weren't good at investigative work, so they weren't taking it to the, you know, to the finishing line. They thought, you know, we'll hand it over to QA because they'll polish it, they'll finish it up anyway, they'll do it anyway. And you know what? They were probably half getting this idea from QA, who kind of were maybe propagating the notion that nobody could do it, only them, you know. So again, we threaded some RASi through and a dose of mindset shift to Marquette style and another boom. So I didn't expect to like this book, but in the end, it's the one that I found I extracted the most immediate usefulness from. And it is the one that stuck with me most, you know. It's not about just about tactics. It is about trust. It's about, but yeah, and you made a good point there, Laurie. Like, it's not just passing on that trust and responsibility without the training, the tools, the competencies and the abilities and the permission to think and act and decide. So I thought that if people are working in QRM trying to build better facilitation, stronger engagement, more resilient decision making, you know, there's a lot to be taken from this book. So that was my reaction to it. What about you, Nuala?
Oh, I just want to add one thing before you transition to Nuala, is you because I thought Nuala would like this. I actually considered buying this book after I listened to it because of those chapter closures. I thought, oh, I really need those actually, The Audible's not doing that part justice, so I thought you'd appreciate that because I do listen to most of my books.
Well, there you go. Great minds think alike. Oh, I did exactly the same thing because the workbooks were really, really helpful. And I found, I concur with everything you've said. I really did struggle with all of the military language and all the control and command structures and all the rest. I almost gave up. In fact, I did give up. I lost the will to live at one stage and I had to go back to it. And it was only when we started getting into those, now what can you do, that I really found it very, very helpful. And that's exactly, I've ordered the book so that I will have those little workbook tools to do. But listen, we'll be here all night if we don't move on. What about the final book on our shelf, Val? You suggested this one. Now, it isn't the shiny, high-level airport, business guru book. This is a down-in-the-trenches tool book. What should I do on Monday morning, as you said, kind of book, Val? So tell us about it.
Yeah, it's practical. That's what I like about it. And that's the name of it, Quality Risk Management, A Practical Guide by Jim Vesper and Amanda McFarland. Brand new release, timely one too. Let me just say a bit about the authors first. So Jim Vesper and Amanda McFarland are both consultants at Valsource, and they are leaders in the QRM space. Jim has over 40 years of farm experience. He's written 6 books, worked in Eli Lilly forever, I think, is a guru in GMPs, contamination control, QRM. I think a lot of people who work in the QRM space probably have come across Jim or Jim's work. Amanda, on the other hand, is a senior consultant, a very strong background in microbiology, recognized expert in integrating risk into quality systems and contamination control strategies. And again, if you're working with Annex 1 or trying to comply with Annex 1, you've probably read or heard of Amanda's work already. So this book's actually an update of Jim's 2006 book. So I did reach out to Jim and ask him, you know, why write a new one, you know, and he just said, well, ICHQ 901 updated, of course. So, you know, they could see the industry was grappling with it from a practical point of view, putting that word in caps. And so that's why he decided to go about the update. And then Amanda added that Annex 1, you know, that too was introduced, updated, expanded. And, you know, it demands a lot of QRM and a grounded, practical approach to QRM. You know, when you look at micro risk, contamination control, clean room practices, and all this is in her wheelhouse. So they're the authors. Now, some of our regular listeners might remember in January, we sat down with Professor Kevin O'Donnell, and he reminded us that ICHQ 901 isn't gospel, it's science, right? Well, that's what inspired me to recommend this book, because if you have and you need science, you need a good textbook. And that's what this book is. It's a really good textbook for QRM. I think Jim and Amanda have seen it firsthand. You know, the struggles team face when it actually comes to practically executing and designing and living through a QRM process. And many folks sometimes when they're asked to do this, sometimes have very little training in the tools or understanding those cognitive biases that influence our decisions, or, you know, all the things that come with QRM that sometimes take decades to accomplish and to learn. Well, this is a how-to guide. It's not just a what and when. The word practical is in the title, and it's not there by accident, you know. And the authors make a strong case that QRM is about managing knowledge. Just to map it to what Amy Edmondson was saying, you know, it's not just about managing risk. It is about learning, adapting and facilitating the right conversations. So, and actually, for those of you that are facilitating QRM, there's a whole chapter in there about your role and, you know, whether you're doing it in person or virtually. No, and they don't just emphasize tools either. You know, they put in 8 thoughtful questions. And you know what? If that's all you did, this book would take you a long way. So, you know, I really did think it was a very strong textbook. And if we look at risk as a science, then this is the text. Now, I do have a couple of critiques. Will I drop them in there as well? And they're said with affection because I do know the authors, right? My first one was, it would have been nice if there were just a few more visuals. I'm a bit of a visual learner and I like diagrams and pictures. And, you know, it is a textbook, it is a dense read. And I just thought, you know, maybe a few more illustrations might have helped me anyway. And the second thing is, you know, I think it still focuses a little on the qualitative QRM, and I would have liked to see more on data-driven approaches, you know, where we're looking at data models and vast quantities of data. I think in today's digital world, we do need to push harder, you know, the understanding of modeling and how to use large data sets. So anyway, I'm only teeing Amanda and Jim up there for a sequel. So, you know, I think that will come. Finally, I think I can't stop talking about the book without mentioning the price. Like, it is pricey. It's $230 to $250, depending on your membership of the PDA, because it's available in the PDA bookstore. Not cheap. But then again, it's a textbook. And I think within the price range of textbooks, that's probably there or thereabouts. And it's a solid one. So look, if you're new to QRM, this book will teach you how to think risk. If you're experienced, I think it will teach you how to facilitate and improve your risk management and your control of risk. And if you're leading QRM in your organization, you know, and you don't need to know all this, it's a great dip in and a go-to for real world detail and application. So I think it's one of the resources you'll keep close by, as with its forerunner, which I think was a staple in the QRM community for the last decade. I think this would be a staple in the next decade. So folks, I don't know what your reactions to it were.
I'll just start off by saying I thought it was a fun intro. It talks about the history of risk management. I thought that was really neat. It captured me right from the beginning. Of course, I am a bit of a risk nerd, like the rest of us are on this call. But I thought that part was really neat to kind of go back in time and sort of talk about risk management and kind of lead into the tools and practicality piece of it. I agree. The visuals would have been nice. I also like diagrams and pictures to kind of pique my interest. And I'm also constantly visualizing things in my head when I'm reading. And so it helps if I have a little bit of help along the way. And I think for a newer person to QRM, it might be a little bit of a challenge if without those visuals too, whereas many of us have been doing this for a long time, we can kind of visualize already. But all in all, I thought it was very good practical application. You can't go wrong with, I've worked with both of the authors before in my past. They're great. They're knowledgeable. No doubts there at all. So I think it's a good read. The price is killing me. the price is killing me. So probably it would be great if they did something maybe outside of PDA in the future too. It would be really nice. Maybe that price could be a little bit more reasonable too. But it's a great, great book. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I loved it. It's a practical guide. It's very useful. All of the things that you've mentioned, it is a bit of a dense read. I'm not so sure that some of the early folks who are perhaps, you know, recently acquired responsibility for as a risk lead, or, you know, they may not be a QRM expert. They may be a process expert who happens to be a risk lead for their area. I can't see them sitting down. I regularly work with organizations and we're looking at, you know, selecting risk champions or risk leads within the business and trying to work with them. And I find it difficult for them to turn up to their training and learning, having read ICHQ9, and that's 9 pages or, you know, 10 pages. You'd read it over a coffee break, as I say to them. But often I find on the first day of working with those teams on their coffee break, I've said, right, don't come back from coffee until you've read Q9 R1, please. You know, you came to a QRM training and you're now a QRM lead. So you actually can't progress without reading the industry harmonized guidance on it. So I think for those folks, it still might be, you know, too much of a lift for them to head into a very dense kind of textbook. And that's why perhaps there'll be some companion material that will come, you know, whether it's through PDA conferences or whatever, whether that's webinars or, you know, some visuals on a slide deck and presentations and thing that might helping distill some of those ideas. So I look forward to seeing some books in the future. But as we know, Professor O'Donnell Kevin, I think he wrote the foreword for this book, and he always referred to Jim's 2006 book as his Bible, his go-to. So I'm sure there will be many of us who will refer to this. I particularly loved the facilitator section. And I think that's where, you know, that is a significant advance on, you know, what a lot of other practical guides had dealt with before. I think there's some really helpful things in there.
Just to add to your point there, you know, I think each of these three books in their own way were a little bit dense.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, the Edmondson's book were quite theory heavy. The Marquette book, a lot of military, and, you know, and this book is dense because it's, you know, it's a textbook, it's science. Yeah. So, you know, it's about your motivation, really, and how motivated you are to learn more, to dig deep, to become more expert. You know, I think you need a dollop of motivation for any one of these three books. They each have their own little bit of
density. But look, they're all coming at it from a common theme, which is about learning. Correct. It's about curiosity and learning.
Curiosity. Mm-hmm.
And you know, some people will have that intrinsic motivation to do this. The likes of us nerds who will go and read these books anyway, because that's what we like to do. And we like to dig for new information and new cues. But equally within organizations, I think we've got to get this redefined leadership, as Amy Edmondson talks about, of finding ways of making this much more part of the way in which we work, so that we're not just on the hamster wheel. We've got to find times in our working week or month where an internal book club is had, and even if it's only asking each people to read one chapter each and then give a little coffee morning, 5 minutes discussion on the chapter and what they found, or what was their, you know, what was their key takeaway, their big aha from each of the chapters. Like, even that is a way of encouraging, with a bit of external factor, encouraging motivation, actually making it part of the expectation around your individual development and your competence building that Marquette talks about. Some people will take this on as their individual responsibility, but most won't, because they're so busy, you know, fighting fires and like I say, running on the hamster wheel. So our leaders and our teams have to find ways in which they can build learning and competency development into their working week or working month, whether that, like I say, a lunch and learn session or an internal book club or a reflection on a recent deviation, something like that. We've got to build those factors in, and they've got to be sacrosanct, you know, and people have to sign up and participate, engage. And you don't dial it in. So I would urge listeners to encourage their teams to start thinking differently about the way in which they can learn, the way in which they can reflect on their own mistakes, but also what's lifting their head above the parapet and what's going on externally in the industry, very important. And, you know, I guess that's the thing for me. They all come at this about it being a good thing to celebrate learning and to celebrate competency building and to celebrate expertise by experiential learning, by practice. So I think, you know, there's a kind of a common theme. So we've gone from submarines and psychological safety to intelligent failures and practical risk tools. Now, that's not bad for one old bookshelf and book club session. And all of them have come at it tackling the same challenge, like I said, from different angles. It's all about, you know, how do we make better decisions consistently in complex and high stakes environments with humans on the team that, might be embarrassed to acknowledge where they have knowledge gaps. And we have to encourage how that works. And as Marquette reminds us, leadership is a system, not a person. And we don't fix underperformance by shouting louder. We fix it by enabling people who already know what's wrong to get them to speak up and act as well. So, Val, was there something you wanted to add there on Jim and Amanda's recognition?
No, I just think it is the book that gives us sort of operational muscle, the how behind the what. And it's a very practical guide. It is a textbook, and you know, it supports the science of QRM. And I think, you know, we're talking about learning and gaining knowledge. This is the learning that will guide the action in a very practical way. I don't think it's meant to be read end to end. I think it is a dip in book. But you know, put those books together, and I think you get a very strong roadmap.
Yeah, I was just going to add to what you just said too, Val, is I think of all the three books, or four actually, because you touched on two there, Nuala. I think of all of them, Jim and Amanda's book is one of the, because you keep referring to it as a textbook, I just wanted to, I know what you mean by that, and I want to add to that, I guess. It's the one that I think you can keep active to go to. Like the other ones, you read them, you absorb them, you apply some of the things, but, and you may keep them and maybe you go back periodically and go, what was that concept? But I think Jim and Amanda's is kind of that manual that you're going to go
That's
to
a
and sort of,
better word.
yeah, you're going to go to, and I think that's great. And I think that's something to point out about all that we've brought today is it's not a conceptual theoretical, let's talk about some things. It really is that practical application that, and I like how you said dip into. Maybe this, you know what, I've just been told I'm going to enter a facilitation training. What did Jim and Amanda have to say about that in this book? I might want to refer to some of the tips and tricks they've put in there. I'm going to do this remotely on Zoom. How does that work? You know, so I think that's, it's a great, it's like a manual, you know, to go to. I think that's a great concept.
Yeah, no, much better. Handbook or,
Yeah,
playbook.
handbook.
Or,
Yeah.
exactly. Okay, well, listen, we will of course share all the links from the books. Val, did you have some stuff in the show notes for this week?
Yeah, you see. So, of course, in the show notes, we'll share the books once again, as you said. But as I said earlier, I was so unexpectedly taken with that turn the ship around that I did actually scribble down some, you know, a little guide for leader QRM. So I took some of the points out of markets thinking and said, okay, let's put some key points down for QRM thinkers. So practical, actionable points. And there may be one or two Valisms or Risk Revolution podcastisms in there as well. But I'm going to share that slide deck in our Risk Revolution LinkedIn group. So this is a closed group where we chat or hope to chat about what we talk about on the podcast. So go find us on LinkedIn. Hit join, let us know what you think, and that's a special kind of takeaway goodie bag for our group members. So, you know, maybe those ideas could help our risk-based decision making. So, look, folks, let's keep the conversation going on LinkedIn. So, for me, bye from Val.
Bye from Lori.
And bye from Nuala. Thanks, everyone. Keep listening, and we'll see you again next month.